We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. willpledge.org. Now here's your program.
Good morning and welcome to Focus. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. The guest in this first hour of the show is John Hoffmeister. He is the former president of Shell Oil. He was the president of Shell from 2005 until 2008. That was following 25 years working at a number of major energy-consuming companies, including GE, Nortel, Allied Signal. He's now chairman of the board of the National Urban League and also founder of the nonprofit group Citizens for Affordable Energy. And this morning we'll talk about what you'll find in his book, Why We Hate the Oil Companies. The subtitle is Straight Talk from an Energy Insider. It is published by Palgrave Macmillan. And in the book, he makes the argument that oil companies, well, they're pretty much interested in making money. The politicians who set energy policy mostly want to be reelected, and they have a very short time horizon. He says they look no further than the next campaign. He said, as a result of both of these factors, the United States really has no real energy policy. He makes some arguments for what kind of energy policy we should have, how we can meet our energy needs in the book. You can take a look at that, hear what he has to say, and of course, questions are welcome. We ask people, please keep it to a question, keep it brief, and stay on the topic, and that way we can get in as many people as we can and make good use of the time. But certainly, questions from people who are listening are welcome. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455 is the number. We also have a toll-free line that is good anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. And you may also send your comments by email to will-talk@illinois.edu. So at any point here, certainly questions are welcome. And Mr. Hoffmeister, hello.
Hello, David. How are you?
I'm fine. Thanks. And yourself?
Thank you for having me.
Good. Well, thanks very much for talking with us. Well, I think that I'm interested in what you have to say, and we'll see what reaction we have from people here. I guess my concern is that right away, depending on how people approach this subject, that they will see you as someone who continues to be, say, a representative of the industry. In the sense that you're concerned with its public relations and trying to present it in the best possible way, even though you don't work directly in the industry anymore.
I do care about the industry because I care about what the industry produces and its impact on our society and on our economy and on our lifestyle. So I would not describe myself as an apologist for the industry, because many of the comments that I've made in my book with respect to the industry do not sit well with the industry. And in my foundation, Citizens for Affordable Energy, my board and I have concluded together that we should not take any money from energy-producing companies so that we would not be seen as a public relations arm of the industry. So I did retire from Shell. I do not have any income coming from the industry, and as a consequence, I feel that I'm independent in terms of what I can say and what I am saying.
Mm-hmm. Well, as far as the industry is concerned, it seems that you're saying is that maybe we shouldn't be surprised, and in a sense, maybe we should not blame the oil industry for trying to maximize profits, because after all, that's what big industry does.
You're absolutely right. That's what they do. There are many people in Congress, there are many citizens that I've met, who say, why don't the oil companies figure out our energy future for us and go make it happen? And my response to that is, well, depending upon the company, some may want to do that, but many won't. Many are simply in the oil and gas business, have no interest in the diversifying into other forms of energy, and they would not see themselves as competent to pursue other forms of energy because that's what they've chosen to do. And so I've met so many people across the country who say, you know, well, why don't all the oil companies just get into all forms of energy because they have the money to do that, and then they can all, you know, just go happily along our way. It's not that simple. There are, however, some of the big oil companies, like my former company, Shell, BP, and ConocoPhillips and Chevron, that have branched out into forms of renewable energy to test the market, to test the capabilities. And ExxonMobil, as people may know, is stretching out into the algae world with a big, big investment. So there is some outreach, but my bigger point in the book is because the oil companies do what they do and utilities do what they do to produce electricity, their primary job in life is to satisfy their investors that they're getting a return. Their job is not in their corporate charters to solve the nation's energy problems going forward. To me, that's the role of government. And it's government failure to do that, which is what I think should concern all Americans.
Well, why do you think it is that government has failed to do that?
I think, first of all, it's a complex subject, and I think it's difficult for people outside the business to get their heads around it. So that's a human factor. I think also, as you said in your introduction, many of our elected officials are really focused on what I call in the book political time. And that is the cycle between now and their next election, or the cycle between when they decide to run for office and the time in which they would have the election. And they become very short-term focused on the flavor of the day priority. And if that happens to be high gas prices, then they're going to focus on high gas prices. If that happens to be environmental issues in their district or their state, then they will focus on that for that election. What they have trouble doing, and this has never happened, at least in my lifetime, which is going on 60-plus years now, they have never concentrated on an energy strategy or an energy policy that would have life beyond a single administration, a single president, or life beyond a Congress that has a majority rule by Republican or majority rule by Democrat. And what we really need in this country is a 10, 20, 30, ultimately 50-year strategy to remake the energy system of this country for the 21st century and preparing for the 22nd century. Energy is a long-term commitment, and the proof in the pudding is during the years from 19-teens to the 1970s, this country built the biggest ever known in the world energy system, and we've frankly been living off of it the past 40 years. We haven't really invested in a new energy system since we built the nuclear plants, since we built all the coal plants across the country, since we opened up the deep water Gulf of Mexico 40 years ago. We really haven't invested in something big and new and different that takes care of our future generations' energy needs. And Congress has been unable to put a program together that would, in essence, do just what I said.
Mm. One thing that you start right out talking about is that it seems that no matter what else we do, what we do in terms of where the energy comes from, what we do in terms of making more efficient use of energy, one thing that we can say is that we expect that that the demand for energy will continue to grow.
Yes. I know there are people who say, look, we can be much more efficient in the use of energy. And yes, we can be more efficient in the use of energy, but only when we apply new technology to our use of energy, such as smart grid technology, such as energy-efficient appliances, or perhaps the elimination of the internal combustion engine in our automobiles, preferring a different kind of technology, such as batteries or perhaps hydrogen fuel cell. I don't expect individual people to change their behaviors very much. When it's cold in winter, we want heat. When it's hot in summer, we want air conditioning. When it's dark at night, we want lights. When we're watching television, we want a really good television. Interestingly, the HD TVs that many people are buying use twice as much electric current as the TVs that they're replacing, and because it has a much denser picture, which people love. And in addition, what many people who promote efficiency fail to also recognize is that our population is not static. Our population as a country continues to grow. And I think we like that generally as a nation. We like growth of population because that generally suggests growth of the economy, more people buying houses, cars, food, and other things that people work on to produce. So I think that the demand for energy in the post-industrial information age in which we live will continue to grow because we like electronics. I mean, that's another reason. We like the information processing that electronics provides, whether that's at a personal level in our homes with a new iPad or a new PC or whatever it may be, or the banks, the hospitals, the academic institutions, the city halls, the state governments, companies. Everybody likes information, and that's all powered by electronics. Mm.
And just one other thing that, again, in spite of what people would like to see happening with green energy and its potential, the potential for renewables, you argue, and this is maybe something people won't like to hear, but your argument is that for the foreseeable future, we will continue to have to rely very heavily on fossil fuels, traditional fossil fuels.
I frankly don't see any way around it. And while it's exciting to consider dramatic change in the sources of energy, while it's tantalizing to think if you're on a farm of having your own series of windmills or solar panels or anywhere if you have space in your property, and to think about contributing to the grid without carbon emissions or any other kind of emissions, it's exciting to think about that. But the reality is those new forms of energy, ranging from solar, wind, and biofuels, have less energy content in what they produce than what we're used to consuming from fossil fuels. And furthermore, we currently have 600 major coal plants in this country producing 49% of all of our electricity. People say, let's get rid of coal in 10 years. That's a big advocacy group promoting that. Well, what do we do to replace 49% of our electricity in 10 years? We have no plan to do that, and wind and solar won't do it. People say, well, let's go to battery vehicles and not use as much foreign oil. Yeah, that's a good aspiration, but the fact of the matter is 250 million cars on the roads of America today need gasoline or diesel, and that's not going to change until those cars are sold or retired by their owners. So we can all aspire to a different energy system, but today's infrastructure is predicated on hydrocarbons, 49% of our electricity from coal, another 22% of our electricity from natural gas, which is a hydrocarbon. Most of our cars, planes, ships, boats, trains all use hydrocarbon diesel or liquid or gasoline. And that's not going to change in the next 5 years or the next 10 years because those cars are going to be around a long time. And the new cars being built today are not all hybrids. They're not all battery cars. They're internal combustion engine cars. So we're continuing to produce the cars, which will continue to need gasoline. We can blend some ethanol or other biofuels into that gasoline, but gasoline will still remain the primary motor fuel for the foreseeable future. Mm.
I think that one of the things that that some people like to talk about is the potential for the United States to be energy independent. And it seems that that's the kind of argument that people make. They say, well, we could do that if we lifted restrictions on oil exploration in this country, particularly in the coastal waters of the country. And perhaps they might also make the argument that other forms need to be explored, that we also ought to get back to nuclear power, you know, whatever. But I think also one of the things that you say is kind of sobering is that you might as well forget energy independence, that's just not going to happen.
We can forget it because it won't happen, because it can't happen, but also I think it should not happen, and here's why. We don't have enough oil in this country to meet our daily demand on a sustained basis over many decades. We have plenty of oil to contribute to our domestic needs, and we should develop that. I offer a plan in the book that's the most aggressive domestic production plan for providing our own liquid fuels that I've seen in really the last several decades. And it is to suggest that today's production of 7 million barrels of oil per day, which we produce, against a demand of 20 million barrels, I'll say it again, 20 million barrels is what we consume. We produce 7. That means we import 13 million barrels of oil every day. We could, knowing what we know about the oil resources in this country, produce 3 million more barrels, which we've done before. We used to be at 10 million barrels in the 1970s. Now we're at 7. We could produce 10. We could produce enough biofuels to equal 2 million barrels a day, and that should be a goal, I think. And so that would take us equivalent to 12. We could then reduce the mile per gallon consumption with more efficient cars, which might give us another 1 or 2 million barrels a day equivalent of fuel. That gets us to about 13 or 14 million barrels a day equivalent. That means we still need 6 or 7 million barrels a day coming from elsewhere, Mexico or Venezuela or Middle East or wherever it comes from, while China is also competing for those imports to their country. We actually have a whole lot more oil than China does. I think we should produce it. But getting back to the key point here on energy independence, I think energy is a commodity that helps us trade for foreign payments. In other words, if our farmers across this country could grow more biofuels than we consume, why wouldn't we want to trade that into the open market? If we produce natural gas more than what we need, why wouldn't we want to liquefy that and trade it into the open market? So we're not an island, is my point. And I think being part of the global trading system both benefits us, but we also need to be a part of it because we can't supply enough of our own fuel.
I have a caller here I want to get to just in a minute. I know you said at the beginning that you were not speaking for the oil companies anymore, but that is a perspective that you come out of, having worked in the oil business for a number of years. And I guess I'm wondering how you reacted to what, again, this is maybe reflecting the attitude of the industry, but that the industry talks, people in the industry seem to talk very much like you do, and they say, well, you know, conservation is all well and good, and we should be doing that, and renewables all well and good, and we should be doing that, but that's just kind of a sideshow, that this economy, this nation, depends on a steady, reliable supply of energy. We're going to continue to need more in the future, and the big resource that we have is coal and oil, and we are going to continue to need to exploit that to the fullest extent to meet our energy needs. And what sometimes I think people in the industry do is that they use that to make the argument that says, essentially, we need to keep on doing what we're doing the way we're doing it, and there ought to be as little regulation as possible, and that we ought to be producing as much as possible because that's the only way we can meet the need. And they talk about the future, but it seems that the future never quite gets here because we're so invested in the present.
No, you're right to make that analogy, and I realize that I fall into that a bit, but here's the difference between me and the industry. Mm-hmm. In my last chapter of the book, I lay out a 50-year program that fundamentally transforms the American energy system into a virtually no-carbon emission energy system. But the difference between what you're saying and what I'm saying is that in the first 10 to 15 years of this new energy system, we must continue to do a lot, in fact, everything that we're doing today, because that's the system we have. Mm-hmm. And we can't just cut our nose off to spite our face. We've got to have gas, we've got to have coal, because that's what we have. If we didn't have it, that'd be great. We could move faster, but we do. And we got to keep the lights on for everybody, not just a few who are willing to pay ultra-high prices to keep their lights on by only using certain new forms of energy. So for all Americans to have their lights on and to have gasoline available for the first 10 to 15 years, doing more of what we do, then during that period of time, we're starting to plan how and start taking action on how we're only going to build plants in the future that use clean coal technology, which is coal gasification, not the burning of coal, which is very different, with carbon capture and sequestration, which means bury the carbon we capture when we gasify the coal. I also say in the book, let's double the number of nuclear plants. We have 104. Let's have over 200 nuclear plants, reducing the need for future coal plants. Let's continue to build natural gas plants, but let's really expand the wind and the solar to make a material difference. The kind of wind and solar investments we're making thus far, David, are just peripheral. It's frittering at the edges, the small number. Mm-hmm. The number of wind farms and solar farms I'm talking about would require not hundreds, not thousands of wind towers, but hundreds of thousands. That's material wind energy, hundreds of thousands. And then we would need the transmission lines, and preferably direct current transmission lines, not alternating current transmission lines, which are very wasteful of electricity that when you transmit. But so these are major, major reformations that would be all paid for with private money. And by 2060, as I describe it, with clean coal, with nuclear, with serious investment in wind and solar. And solar, by the way, which is much advanced in technology from today's solar energy, which is very inefficient. We need to get to 30-40% efficiency in solar material composites, where today it's around 8-10% efficient. We can really do a tremendous job of positioning ourselves for the rest of the century and moving into the succeeding century if we begin today. But it's a 50-year journey. That's my big point.
Our guest in this hour is John Hoffmeister. He served as the president of Shell Oil Company from 2005 until 2008, and he is now the chairman of the board of National Urban League and also founder of the nonprofit group Citizens for Affordable Energy, and he's trying to get some conversation going about the energy policy, what kind of energy policy we should have, where should we be moving. If you're interested in reading some more about this, you can find it in his book, Why We Hate the Oil Companies. The subtitle is Straight Talk from an Energy Insider, and it's published by Palgrave Macmillan. We have a couple of callers here are ready to go. Questions certainly are welcome. Please, though, we hope people can be brief. That way we can get as many callers as possible. But we'll take calls, and all you have to do is call us, 333-9455. That's for Champaign-Urbana. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. We have a couple of callers here ready to go. The first is in Spring Bay, and that's line 4. Hello.
Oh, good morning. I think this is perhaps one of the most important conversations or topics that we can be having these days. Now, was it Shell that was running a group of ads about willyoujoinus.com?
I believe I've seen those ads, yes,
was
but
that
it's
Shell?
Not. Oh, no, that was
about
Chevron. Sorry, that was a Chevron.
Was it Chevron? Okay.
Yeah.
But this energy situation is, you know, a pretty important thing for all of us. The Hirsch report from the Department of Energy came out a few years back, and he was saying that we need to mitigate the effects of peak oil. We're going to need a 20-year time horizon, and the way that he characterized it in that report was that the disruptions that we could be looking at are unprecedented in human history. You talk about how much oil we have in this country. This oil we have in the untapped reserves right now, we're going to need that oil in the future to build this green economy energy infrastructure, it seems to me. With oil companies becoming nationalized, I think the move is already on for Saudi Arabia and other countries to start containing their supply of oil for their own domestic needs. And we've got the Alaska and offshore and all of that. We're going to need some energy to build these wind towers and turbines and all of that. So what do you think about that point of view?
Well, the good news is this nation is endowed with tremendous quantities of its own natural resources in crude oil. The Bakken Shale in North Dakota is now producing, which has always been there, but they estimate that's about 500 billion barrels worth of oil in the Bakken area of North Dakota and Montana, there are over a trillion barrels of oil located in the Piceance Basin of western Colorado, Wyoming, and Utah, unconventional oil that is currently in solid form, which would need to be produced as a liquid. There's offshore Alaska, offshore California, offshore Gulf of Mexico, maybe some material oil off the East Coast to be developed. So I'm not too worried about a long-term availability of oil. What I worry about more is our willingness as a society to produce it. And that has been a problem. And that's why we had $4 gasoline 2 years ago, our unwillingness to produce our own oil when the rest of the world is also competing for what oil is out there. The other thing which I think is I'm optimistic about, and Germany and Japan are already making progress on this point, is looking for an alternative to the internal combustion engine. The internal combustion engine in our cars is a 100-year-old machine that is only 20% efficient. It seems to me we ought to be concentrating on doing something better than that.
Yeah.
And I'm a believer that hydrogen fuel cell technology, which Germany and Japan are beginning to exploit, which the U.S. is falling behind on, unfortunately, because our government cannot continue a program past a single administration. So the Bush administration promoted hydrogen fuel cell vehicles, and the new administration decided that's not what we want to do. We're going to promote something else instead, and have pulled back investment in that opportunity. And so if we change out the internal combustion engine for a different power source, we save tremendous amounts of oil and we'll never need because we don't use it in engines anymore. And I think we'll be fairly comfortable with the supplies that we would have in the future.
Just one last thing, and I'll get off, David. I think that different power source is certainly a great idea, but it would take probably 30 years to get that to happen from where we're sitting today. And in the meantime, we may have some energy constraints looking us square in the face.
You're exactly right on the 25 to 30 year time horizon.
Yeah,
if George Bush started it in 2002, and he said in his State of the Union speech that a child born today by 2020 would have the option of choosing a hydrogen fuel cell vehicle, it looks like now that goal is not going to be met. And it would be somewhere well into the 2020s before that's likely to occur. And the big transition happening if we chose to proceed now in the 2030s.
In terms of our current situation, the Bakken field, I think I've read where possibly it could generate maybe 2 million barrels a day tops, that it's just highly energy inefficient to try to, energy return on energy invested is hard to get it above that 2 million barrels a day. I'll get on. There was another point that I wanted to bring up to you, but I can't quite think of it now. I'll get off.
All right. Well, thank you for the call. Let me just ask you, Mr. Hoffmeister, real quick. I'm sure that there were people who will hear your reference to the Bush administration and say, well, yes, the president, in fact, did stand up there and talk about the problems associated with our dependence on oil. And he talks about the idea that maybe we could build a new economy built on hydrogen. And then, though, people will point out to the fact that when the administration came into office and they started to try to craft an energy policy for the country, they did it by organizing closed-door sessions led by the vice president, Mr. Cheney, and they invited the representatives of the big oil company to the table. But there was nobody there to represent the alternatives. There was nobody there to represent consumers. It was still very much an insider kind of a project. And that doesn't really make it sound like an administration that's interested in changing things.
And it blew up in their faces because of the secrecy involved. And it was a mistake. And I don't think anything ultimately came of it other than the tarnished reputation of trying to do something in secret. And so the Bush administration did move into biofuels. It did promote hydrogen, which was not promoted by the oil companies at all. This was independent of the oil companies and was being promoted, really, by the Biofuels Association. Certainly the Farm Belt of this country had a big influence over that. Hydrogen being promoted by many different interest groups. And so I think there has been a robust, and in the Obama administration, to their credit, the continued representation by the wind, by the solar, by the biofuels folks, I think is having a positive impact on changing things. And so what we really need, and I make the point in the book, is we need energy from all sources. There should not be a right way and a wrong way, a good energy and a bad energy, because if we're really serious about having an economy that is robust, that is fueled by energy, because that's what fuels an economy, then we need to be looking at all energy sources, not being selective, not looking for that ultimate silver bullet that might be out there, because there is none. And what I worry about is between administrations, there seem to be preferences for certain types of energy over other energy, and then we set ourselves backwards instead of continuously promoting all forms of energy and at the same time promoting new technology for the efficient use of that energy. And so that's where we really do need the government to provide some strategic leadership in this area, which just has not been happening.
All right, let's go to another caller, Urbana, line one. Hello.
Hello. I thought I read that less than 1% of the major oil companies' profits is devoted to alternative energy sources. And that tells me that the oil companies are only giving lip service to green power. What's your thoughts there?
Yeah, I think your statistic is correct. It's about 1% of profits overall. However, certain different companies do commit more than that. But if you look at the total, I believe your number is correct. And this goes back to my point made earlier both my book and the program that the oil and gas companies, many of them see themselves as nothing more and don't want to be any more than oil and gas companies, and that they don't really feel that they have any interest in or capability for other forms of energy. So to satisfy their investors, they're just going to do oil and gas.
Can you tell me if there are this recent catastrophe in the Gulf has spurred any inspection of the thousands of used and abandoned oil wells in the Gulf area?
I don't know that it has or hasn't. I'm sorry, I don't have that information. I know that the company that I belonged to previously kept monitoring its properties way into the future, even when they were abandoned, because they're still liable. So there was a program to continuously check to make sure that there were no problems or difficulties. I don't know about other companies, nor do I know what the government does in that regard with respect to the whole industry.
All right. I want to thank the caller and go to a caller over in Vermilion County nearby, Belgium. Line two. Hello.
Hello, and good morning to you all. I must preface what I'm going to say by first stating that, you know, just like the statements we hear about clean coal, there is no such thing as clean coal. Clean coal destroys the environment. As soon as you start mining it, it starts destroying it, and it continues on from there. And when you start talking about Western oil, most of that is tied up in oil shales and stuff like that. And they depend a great deal on water, and they also depend upon destroying the surface of the ground to get it out. If you go up into Alberta in Saskatchewan, you'll see where the oil shales and oil tars up there, tar sands, they just absolutely destroy the environment, and it's not a clean way for energy. It's not where we want to go, even though there may be huge quantities of energy there. They're tied up in such a way that we don't have the water to get reduced to reduce it down to the oil. It's very expensive to do, and it requires a lot of water. But the question I really wanted to address to you, and Mr. Inge just brought up a little bit, was hydrogen. Hydrogen is where we have to go. If you look at Germany and Japan, they're rapidly going in those directions because they know that technology is going to reap dividends to their economies, because once they improve it to the point that it works properly, they're going to sell it to everybody else in the world, and they're going to reap the profits of it. Why the United States has not taken the advantage of what we used to do back in 1900 when we were innovative and Edison and those people said, let's move on, we've lost that desire. We don't have the desire to go in different directions. Why?
Yeah, well, I think you make a very, very good point, both of your points. And I do assert in the book there's no such thing as clean energy. Every form of energy,
hydrogen is clean energy.
Let me come back to hydrogen in a moment. But with respect to other forms of energy, the every form of energy, from wind farms to solar farms to oil fields to coal mines, every form of energy has what we're talking about there have some environmental implications, create some level of environmental degradation which must be addressed for purposes of sustainability and social responsibility. So I agree with that. With respect to hydrogen, I make the point in the book that we are missing out here. Just like you said, sir, we are missing out here, and we will lose global leadership. And Japan and Germany, which are really focused on the automotive industry, but other technical industries as well, will shame us because of our unwillingness to take the risks associated with the major change that hydrogen would represent. Hydrogen can absolutely be clean, probably the cleanest of all energies, because it comes from water. And the electrolysis of water can produce that energy. And if the electricity to electrolyze the water is renewable energy, then we've got it made. We've got a virtuous cycle of clean energy producing hydrogen from water, where the only exhaust is water vapor. It doesn't get any better than that. And for the government, the new administration, the Obama administration, to basically discard the Bush initiative in hydrogen fuel cell automotive technology, I find very difficult to understand.
Well, sir, I'm sure I understand exactly why it's happening, because there are huge lobbying efforts behind big oil and big coal that want to keep it the way it is. Thank you very much.
All right.
Thank you.
Our guest in this hour is John Hoffmeister. He is the former president of Shell Oil Company, was president between 2005 and 2008. He retired in 2008, but he continues to talk about energy issues. He went on to found the nonprofit group Citizens for Affordable Energy, and now is talking about some of the ideas that you will find in his book, Why We Hate the Oil Companies. The subtitle is Straight Talk from an Energy Insider. It's published by Palgrave Macmillan. He has an assessment of our energy needs, how in future we can meet them, and as he said, lays out some ideas for a more comprehensive approach to meeting the country's energy needs that now goes out a number of decades into the future. And questions here are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455, email will-talk@illinois.edu. Let me ask you about something else. Right now, in Europe, I think that around Europe, they're paying about twice, maybe more at some places, more than twice what we pay here in the United States for gasoline. Now, there are some places around the country where around the world where gasoline is really cheap. If you happen to be in the Persian Gulf, your gas is really cheap. But otherwise, it can be very expensive. And some people would make the argument that the reason the people here in the United States are paying less than $3 a gallon, and in some places in Europe, they're paying more than $7, is that the oil industry has benefited from billions of dollars in subsidies and tax breaks and royalty relief from the government. And there are some people who argue that, in fact, if Americans were paying the true cost of gasoline, they wouldn't like it, but it actually would be a good thing because it would spur much more energy conservation consciousness. People would get more interested in mass transit. You know the arguments. What do you think about that?
Well, I had the opportunity to live in Europe for about 8 years, and what I found different in Europe than exists in the U.S. is Europe has gone into the automotive age knowing that throughout Europe there is a scarcity of crude oil. There was the North Sea, but the North Sea is mostly in decline now. But other than the North Sea, Europe always had to be looking upon oil as an imported product, and they would always be vulnerable. So they never wanted their countries in Europe, the various sovereign states, to get too committed to the automotive based upon imported oil. So what they did, and this is true across Europe, they put tremendous amounts of investment into mass transit, so that you could literally travel your whole life, see the entirety of the world, and never have to own an automobile because of the mass transit systems that extend all across the countries, rural folks as well as urban folks. The U.S. took a different approach. The U.S. had an abundance of oil through the 20th century. We built the interstate highway system to facilitate mobility. We became a car-based society, personal vehicle-based society, and we disinvested in much of our mass transit across the country, becoming entirely dependent upon the vehicle for transportation and mobility. And there are very, very few cities now in the U.S. that you would see, say, would have mass transit equivalent in quality and quantity to what you see in most cities in Europe. So we took a different path. And those who would advocate for high gasoline prices to wean people off the use of gasoline, I think, are taking a very elitist approach, perhaps even an arrogant approach, to say, you know, make everybody pay more, and I really don't care if that harms people who can't afford high-priced gasoline because gasoline is bad for us. I don't think they have the right to decide that fundamentally, unless there's a more government-driven effort, because we all elect our government, the government-driven effort to invest, you know, in mass transit so that those who are less fortunate, those who are on fixed income or low-income folks, still have access to national mobility. Why should anybody be denied national mobility if others can have it? And that's what they have with low-cost gasoline. So I think there's been a priority over many decades to keep gasoline affordable because that enables people from all income levels to travel where they want to travel at their leisure. So it's two different, very different systems, and I don't think we can lay one on the other and say it's better or worse and that we should, you know, suddenly Americans should wake up and be just like the Europeans. It won't happen. We'd have to spend decades building mass transit.
Well, that's it. Your point here to a significant problem, really two significant problems. Not only on the one hand do we have a certain mindset that governs the way that we think about energy and we use it, and we've had that for a long time, but also we have an infrastructure in place that favors the personal vehicle. And that changing a mindset is one thing, but changing infrastructure, now that's something else.
And government has learned the hard way that Americans don't like high-priced gasoline. If we go back to the $4 a gallon, we heard the chanting of drill, baby, drill, and we saw the Congress eliminate the ban on offshore drilling, which had been in place for 30 years. Now, we have 250 or 270 gasoline, and people aren't too worried about more offshore drilling right now, so there's not much taking place in that regard. But also, the last time the federal gas tax was raised was 1993, during the Clinton administration, when they proposed a 6 cent a gallon increase in the federal gas tax. Congress approved 3 cents, and the Congress changed majority at the next election, in part because people didn't like to see the federal gas tax raised. So this, you're absolutely right about mindset. It really does care. With respect to the subsidies that the big oil companies get, I personally testified in Congress, as other big companies also did, that the subsidies at prices, well, crude oil prices above a certain level make no sense whatsoever, and they should be abolished. But where the subsidies do matter, it's not the big oil companies like Exxon and Shell and Chevron, et cetera. It's for the little independents. The little independents, which create tens of thousands of jobs, do need or have needed in the past some kind of security against the volatility of crude oil price. Remember, 10 years ago, it was $10 a barrel. Today, or 2 years ago, it was $147 a barrel. So a lot of little companies do benefit, and I think, and I'm not opposed to that, in order for the kind of stability to be provided where it's needed.
We have just about 5-6 minutes, and now I have a number of callers, so we'll try to get in at least a couple. Next up will be Naperville, line 4. Hello.
Hello. I want to say first that I agree with, firstly, all of what you're saying this morning. There's just one thing that I would like to make sure is acknowledged and recognized, and that, for example, with the hydrogen fuel cell vehicles, and you said that hydrogen is generated by electrolysis of water, but that takes energy. And initially, that energy is provided by fossil fuel plants. So until we get beyond that stage or get into some of the advanced treatment plans like carbon sequestration that you mentioned, we still have that issue of using fossil fuels. I just parenthetically, there was an article in the paper this morning about a new electric car, and the writer was primarily writing about testing the car, but then he concluded by saying it's a car that leaves no carbon footprint, and yet you have to recharge the batteries, and the electricity currently comes from largely, you said, from about 50% fossil fuel plants. So I think we have to keep that on the table as we understand these issues.
Thank you. You're right. And if we had more time, I could go into the evolution of today. Most hydrogen would probably be produced by natural gas, which is a fossil fuel. The kind of electrolysis I'm referring to would be sort of in the latter part of the 50-year program that I describe in my book, because it would take that long to transition from some of the fossil fuel to the more nuclear, the clean coal with carbon capture and sequestration and so on, which would be ultimately getting us to a point where clean energy produces clean hydrogen. So it would take an evolution over decades. You're absolutely right.
All right. Let's talk with someone in Effingham next. Line one. Hello.
Yes. I, again, would like to interject the spirit of capitalism in all these enterprises, the effects of it with consumerism, the outlandish effects of 7.2 billion people on this earth, where just a tiny minority have access to the very things being talked about, and try to evolve that forward to where we could even take in half of the world's population is utterly impossible. Thank you, David.
Well, I don't know if you can respond or how you would respond to something like that.
It's a very good point. Much of the world only has energy by burning wood or dung. That's it. They don't have candles. They don't have electricity. And many other parts of the world might have a single light bulb, or they might have a TV set, which they are stealing from for the electricity from a wire that goes somewhere near them. And they, so in other words, the world is under-resourced in terms of total energy supply. And that presents a huge challenge to the Earth itself, the biosphere of the Earth. If every part of the world lived as Americans do, we would be really seriously challenged to be able to meet the ecological conditions that would perhaps come from that. It's not to say we shouldn't try to provide more energy to all people, and I advocate that in my book, but we have to be mindful of the environmental conditions that would have to be dealt with at the same time.
Another caller here in Normal. This is line two. Hello.
Yes, following up on something an earlier caller said, I always worry about the unintended consequences of actions we take. And I think about the battery-powered cars that are in hybrids now. What happens if all of our cars were to turn to hybrids? And down the road, where do all those batteries go?
Yes, and I make that point also in that if the batteries go to be decommissioned in third world countries using child labor and the heavy metals that are part of those batteries are left to drift into waterways and affect our rivers and then our oceans, we really haven't helped ourselves very much. Americans might be patting themselves on the back for their so-called clean energy usage, but yet the effects, as you say, the unintended consequences have in incredible negative environmental consequences on some other country. And that all has to be thought of in a systemic way so that we look at the whole system, not just a part of the system.
All right. Well, I hope that gets at the question of the caller. We're down to the point we have about a minute or so left, and I'm interested in one thing that we have not touched on, something that you talk about in your book that I think is at least an interesting idea, and that is that in order to have a more long-term energy policy, something that's not just an attempt to satisfy particular interest, you make the argument that what we really need is a kind of independent board of governors, something like the Federal Reserve. Of course, people have their problems with that, but something like the Federal Reserve, appointed by the president with consent of Congress, to try to get politics out of the process and have some kind of more objective group that would set energy policy.
Yes, indeed. The real issue of not getting an energy strategy is that politics have dominated the energy conversation. I think energy should dominate the political conversation. And the way for energy to be out there to take care of the needs of ourselves, our children, their children, decades to come, we can't rely on two-year Congresses and four-year presidents, even eight-year presidents or six-year senators. They're not going to get the job done. They haven't in our history. So an independent regulatory agency created by law, by Congress, signed by a president, where governors have 14-year terms. They can live beyond a single presidency, live beyond a given Congress. They could then do four things: more energy from all sources, more efficiency from technology, manage the carbon footprint and other environmental conditions related to energy, and set the pattern for the infrastructure we need to move energy from where it's produced to where it's consumed. I think if we don't do that, we are going to find ourselves in the energy abyss, which I also describe in the book. Staying on our current course, we will be in gas lines, blackouts, and brownouts by the end of this decade. I don't think any of us want that, but that's where we're headed because the old system is old. We need an intervention that changes how we govern energy.
And you think that such an advisory board could be constituted without having undue industry influence as part of it?
It would have to. Nobody lobbies the Fed. And nobody would be able to lobby this Federal Energy Resources Board that I advocate. It would be inappropriate, and it could be made illegal to lobby the Federal Energy Resources Board. Nobody lobbies the Fed. If anybody has ever worked with the Fed, you really can't get inside to talk to the governors. And lobbyists do not advocate with federal governors, Federal Reserve governors. They're isolated from that. And they also don't take taxpayer money to run the Fed. I'm advocating the same principles for the Federal Energy Resources Board.
We are going to have to stop there. We've come to the end of the time. You'd like to read more of John Hofmeister's ideas, you can look for his book, Why We Hate the Oil Companies, Straight Talk from an Energy Insider. It's published by Palgrave Macmillan. John Hofmeister was, from 2005 until 2008, the president of Shell Oil. After he retired, he formed the nonprofit Citizens for Affordable Energy. You want to read more about them, you can go to their website. Mr. Hofmeister, thanks very much for talking with us.
Thank you, David.